Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm glad I made it. I'm feeling gratitude this morning for a number of things, including the cab that just happened to be cruising around in New Westminster. I had a difficult time getting here. There was lots of construction going on the Millennium Line, and it ended up that I had to get off at Columbia Station, and my map, I only had a map for Sapperton to here, so I didn't know where I was. And I was wandering around in this, you know, I went up to one fellow and he only spoke Spanish, and he told me, all I could get from him was that you're a long ways away. So gratitude to that cabbie who just happened to be driving by. With gratitude as well, I welcome this season poised between the equinox and solstice. It's the kind of gratitude that arises from recognition of the fidelity of our imperiled earth to us, whether we deserve it or not. Its axis tilts. Season succeeds season. Darkness wells up ever earlier, one evening at a time, and a bite, a chill is in the air. The rain descends, time for rain gear and umbrellas. We gather more in our homes and in convivial places with family and friends, with food and drink and company to keep the blues at bay. Autumn's winding down, winter, the holiday season, and a new year approaches. Yes, it does. So gratitude, in spite of the looming darkness, in spite of the end of a year, lists of things not done, works not accomplished. Still, there is a time for the reckoning of blessings, of gifts carried, received, given, gifts in which we take deep delight. And that's what I'm feeling and thinking this morning. For that cabbie, that and the need to explore and express, what is it truly that gathers us here? Why are we here and not someplace else? We are the fruits of various experience, growing, ripening, seasoned on the vine of life. And here we are gathered in this place that has a great dance floor, by the way. This hour, this place, with this people to whom we return again and again. And why would that be? Consider the following thoughts as a kind of harvest and year-end reckoning, a naming and praising of the fruits of our religious life, our cornucopia. First of all, it seems clear that we join this congregation and abide together in order to share and enjoy the bounty of community, and of a distinctive kind of community. We humans are social creatures who band together in innumerable forms of solidarity, in communities that cater to our interests and needs for enrichment, friendship, and pleasure. And yet, as essential as each of these may be to address our need to overcome isolation, to enjoy the pleasures of group participation, we know that there's something distinctive and valuable about religious community and of our role in creating it, cultivating it, and harvesting its fruit. This became really clear to me a little over a dozen years ago when, for the first time in my life, I left the community of the religious tradition into which I had been born and raised, and to which I had given heart, thought, and means. Now imagine the horizon of a life unencumbered by formal institutional religious practice. It beckoned. Weekends and evenings would be free from religious duty for the first time in my life. What a relief, I thought. But then, and this is really hard to convey, I knew that for me, the kind of freedom that expresses itself only within family or the company of friends or the sight of daily work, as satisfying as those are and were, they just weren't enough. Insufficient, due to something I couldn't shake or elude, come what may. Sometimes we call it that transcending mystery and wonder, what the Unitarian philosopher James Luther Adams has called our ultimate dependence for being and freedom, that's grounded in and nourished by a creative power and upon transformative processes not of our own making. Well, that sense, that experience has profound consequences. It calls us to renew our spirit and resolve. It calls us to be open to that which creates and upholds life itself. And then, crucially, we sense and see that this transforming reality, that mystery and wonder, finds its richest focus in meaningful human history, in free, cooperative effort for the common good. And here, I believe, Unitarian minister Mark Morrison Reed has it absolutely right when he talks about the common good embodied in liberal religious communities, where he writes this: religious community is essential, for alone our vision is too narrow to see all that must be seen, and our strength too limited to do all that must be done. Together, our vision widens and our strength is renewed. And so, 13 years ago, I put down the Sunday paper and I walked into the doors of the First Unitarian Church of Salt Lake City. And in due time, I became a Unitarian, and the rest, as they say, is history. The distinctive nature of religious community announces itself once you step inside. It has a unique choreography of worship and ritual. Its distinctive language of music, of covenant and high resolve, its affective expression of compassionate solidarity, its dedication to service, service that strives to be present to each and all across the everyday and traditional boundaries of class, of race, status of health, party, gender, and generation. It has its work groups and committees, its mobilization efforts to sustain its vision and translate its values into concrete action and outcome. Put all those things together, and it adds up to what someone remarked to me recently, to say, well, this is just how we do church. All of those things together. Countless gestures, memories, words, deeds, and kindnesses weave the rich fabric of religious community. They're the hallmarks of religious faith and of moral life. They can be found and experienced in many faith communities. We have no monopoly on them. So why are we here and not someplace else? A striking reason for our presence here is manifest each time a Unitarian minister is ordained. Who ordains a Unitarian minister? Do you know? The congregation. Who has the right and the authority? No presiding bishop. Senior ministers don't conduct the rite. To be sure, the minister to be ordained has studied and qualified for ministry. But the sole authority, the power to ordain, is vested exclusively with the congregation. And thus we rise up together, fellow church members, and true to the vision and the 450-year tradition of our faith, we ordain and charge our ministers to serve with us in the spirit of truth, freedom, and love. Power is with the people, and that's why we're here. We're here and not someplace else because, as well, that we claim for us that religion publicly begins with a human covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And that is the criterion of our moral and religious community. In distinction to so many other religions, Unitarianism does not begin with affirmations about the existence, attributes, or sanctity and authority of gods, prophets, priests, or texts. Though it may be imprecise and imperfect as a guide and standard the worth and dignity of the person. At least it honors the truths that the human body, mind, and heart know intimately. It's the kind of principle that promotes social action. From a Unitarian king in 1568, making religious toleration the law of the land, the first such proclamation in human history, to Dorothea Dix, her field research and political work in New England that led to decent housing and treatment of mental patients in the 1840s, to Beacon Unitarians, raising close to $3,000 this year for the Tri-City Homeless Project and putting together more than 100 Christmas bags. Don't forget, Christmas bag packing takes place Wednesday, December 9th, from 1:30 to 4 p.m. Whether it's King Sigismund in the 16th century or Dorothea Dix in the 19th, or Beacon Unitarians today, Unitarian women and men have asserted and worked for the inherent worth and dignity of every soul and supported efforts to secure conditions that make for human dignity. That is the criterion of our moral and religious community. We're here as well and not someplace else in order to provide opportunities for children, youth, and adults to experience a progressive religious and moral education. We welcome questions and ideas. We encourage thoughtful, respectful learning about other religions as well as our own. Our philosophy of education rejects the twin pillars of the fundamentalist mind, with its absolute allergy to doubt and its binary vision of a world divided into black and white. So we support our RE directors and volunteer, and we volunteer to be teachers ourselves, because we know by experience that a free person does not live by an unexamined faith. Belief worth having is worth discussing, testing, and exploring. And that's why we're here. We're here because our advocacy for the right of conscience and the guidance of reason is so important to us. No person should be made to submit to a one-size-fits-all dogma or center of power. And thus, Unitarians have been averse to doctrines, creeds, and hierarchy. We impose none of these as conditions for membership in our congregations. Nor, may I add, are we shy about talking back to our ministers. It's kind of cool, actually. This stance has enabled Unitarians historically to be open to the methods, insights, and results of science, for example. Not that we're unthinking cheerleaders of each theory, each scientific and technological innovation. Still, it is important to acknowledge that the revelations of reason and science, even if they contribute to alter our picture of the cosmos, nature, and the self, these upendings don't have to throw us into a dithering panic. Rather, this stance, this openness to the life and methods of reason and science, should enable us to be flexible, supple, critical, and I would hope humble about what we know and what we don't know. Whenever communities of science actually look for and reach out to communities of faith, they should know that we are here, critical but welcoming friends, neither cheerleaders nor foes, but willing partners in dialogue, a bridging community between the sciences, secular humanism, and religion. So let's think up the list so far to this point. Authority vested in members of each congregation. The worth and dignity of every person as a first principle of our covenant. Progressive religious education. advocacy of the right of conscience and the guidance of reason as guards against idolatries of the mind and spirit. These are some of the fruits of a progressive, questing faith. It's part of our cornucopia of riches. None of them, if you were to take just one in isolation, none of them is unique to us. But together, their combined presence and vigorous expression provide a compelling portrait of a distinctive religious community. The kind of community which gathers us here, the kind of religion to which I can belong without apology, evasion, or a kind of fated gloom. And yet, after having said all that, perhaps what really counts here, finally, is the experience of fellowship. Lord Chesterfield said that congenial society is, in the end, the greatest joy in life. And when I see us meet, embrace, share a cup of tea, extend our feelings in service to one another, I think that if nothing else happened here, making room and time for congenial society would be enough to justify the work you've done to secure a home at the pensioners' hall. And again, besides, you've got a great dance floor. I hope you take advantage of it. And yet, as important as congenial society may be for the enjoyment of life, as important as all the characteristics I've listed above are for gathering us here, still, there remains three distinctive attributes about Unitarianism that, in conclusion, I want to recognize and celebrate this late, wet autumn morning. And they are the Unitarian story, our radical diversity, and our principled commitment to doubt. Nothing in life is as important as discovering and participating in a meaningful story. Whether we have a life partner or are single, whether we're old or young, gay, straight, female, male, you name it, no matter what walk or style of life, finding the right story into which we can write our lives and where we can fruitfully live means all the difference in the world between joy or despair. Now, most of us are here because we discovered sometime in our lives that we were characters in the wrong story, with the wrong people, going in the wrong direction, and that we had to bust out of it or our souls would truly have perished. Now, the Unitarian story is not perfect. No human tale, no cast of characters can be. But of all the options I know of out there, when it comes to religious community and its story, I can abide here, among Unitarians of the past, present, and future, and write out the remaining chapters of my life in good faith. Because it's the tale of a vanguard religious community that possessed the vision, the people, and the tools to smash one religious idol and shibboleth after another. And by doing so, we made it possible, we continue to make it possible, for other religious people more risk-averse than we are, to follow suit, to change, and to grow. We've been radical advocates for a unitary view of the divine and nature, revolutionary scholars of religious texts, leaders in the movement to ordain women and gay and lesbian and bisexual and transgendered persons to the ministry. We're post-Christian religious pluralists. It's an extraordinary story. It really is an extraordinary story. I encourage all of us to learn it and to discover how we will contribute meaningfully to its unfolding now and in years to come. So the Unitarian story makes us, unsurprisingly, unique because it's our own. So the second thing that I think is really distinctive about us is our radical diversity. Another reason why I'm here and not someplace else. People who aren't Unitarian have a hard time getting their minds around just how diverse a collection of religious views and practices are embodied and present in a Unitarian church on a Sunday morning, no matter how patiently I try to explain it to them. Don't take it for granted. Think about it. Under one roof, we're openly pagan, humanist, mystic, and agnostic. We're hard-headed atheists, and we're tender-hearted spiritual souls. The whole realm of religious life and humanistic disciplines are open to us as valued sources of our living tradition. And we bring them all here, and we try our best to make them work in community and in solidarity with one another. There is something so exhilarating, so defiantly saucy and courageous about the endeavor to fashion and practice a radically pluralistic faith, which is what we're about. In a world that's dividing up into grim, panicky, or distressed religious communities, variously troubled, palsied, walled off, or reveling in apocalyptic fantasies, we are a crucial experiment in the possibility of peaceful, frank cohabitation of diverse religious, spiritual, and secular beliefs and practices. Please don't forget for a minute how important this living experiment of ours may yet prove to be to a troubled, divided world. When I survey religious traditions and communities out there, I don't see anything quite like it. And I celebrate it, and may it flourish. And finally, in Sunday school, when I was growing up, I was taught that there was something fundamentally flawed with Thomas, the disciple of Jesus. Remember him? That doubting Thomas, a goat among apostolic sheep, who gets a very bum rap in the Gospel of John. What's his so-called defect? Insisting on tangible proof that the claims by his fellow disciples that Jesus had risen bodily from the grave were not just irrational exuberance. For Thomas, this was too important a matter to be taken merely on hearsay. And for this stance, for this attitude, he's been tarred with the brush of calumny ever since. A negative stereotype, a cliche, as though there's something wrong about being a doubting Thomas. Well, today I'm just going to say that Thomas's demand for tangible fruit made him the most faithful of disciples. Faithful to the young itinerant rabbi who said, quote, "Beware of false prophets. You will know them by their fruits. Every sound tree bears good fruit, but the bad tree bears evil fruit." For 450 years, Unitarians have embraced this pragmatic test of truth. We have not and will not rest content with a faith once given. If our pagan members can deepen our religious life, we embrace them. If our humanists can steer us clear from woolly thinking, we thank them. If our children remind us of the sweetness of youth and of our responsibility to be wise stewards of the future, we honor them and follow their lead. If our mystics accompany us to the sweet well of the great mystery of life, we will drink deep draughts and quench our thirst. If our Christians and Jews remind us of the deep historical roots of our faith in sacred literature and culture, we will bless them for this gift and for their faithfulness. By our fruits we will be known. Fruits tested and tried, claims frankly weighed on the scales of doubt and verified by experimentation. For grapes are not gathered from thorns, nor figs from thistles. Thomas was right, and believed only when he could see and touch the living fruit himself. The harvest we name, see, and honor this day is rich indeed, sufficient to the season thereof, and to our abiding need for a living, credible religion to which we can belong. May we be mindful and grateful for it, and for each other, for this our congenial society, for the story we inhabit and claim as our own, the diversity we enjoy, the loyal, crucial doubt which lights our journey like a star in the night. And may it be so. Amen.